Welcome to the Mystery College Podcast. Today, we have a special guest, Dr. Peter Duchemin. Welcome to the show.
All right. Thank you, Jake.
So, Dr. Duchemin is the inventor of Meta Magic. Would you care to explain a bit more about your system of magic?
Okay. Well, it is called Meta Magic because it incorporates traditional magic into a futurist framework that is compatible with the method of science, compatible with the findings and methodology of the scientific method. It is based on contemporary astronomy to a great degree. At the same time, it is more than a rationalist reductive system. It's more than a materialist system, and it recognizes that the humanities, the arts, and the creative drive and the creative potency of human beings has something more than a psychological impact on the world, is in effect creates the world. So if we accept that the heliocentric hypothesis, for example, Copernican revolution, accept that we are on a planet orbiting the sun, and we accept that the chemical constitution of the universe can be described in terms of atoms, particles, or quanta, and we accept ideas such as the periodic table. At the same time, we can recognize spiritual ideas that have come to us through art and through the ability that we seem to have to evoke acausal displays. So magic is really important. This is not a psychological account of magic. It would seem that the universe is more than just a causal system where A leads to B, leads to C, leads to D. There seems to be something about consciousness and practice and the intensification of awareness that calls into being synchronicities that have no business being there in a mechanistic worldview. So what it looks like is the large-scale structure of reality seems to behave like a dream with a high degree of inertia and collective, almost I want to say tensegrity, whereby that dream is shared, and yet if it is engaged with it, the right kind of energy, these synchronicities, these astonishing synchronicities occur. And this in no way invalidates the findings of science, but rather pushes them through the reductive materialist paradigm into an absolutely awesome vista of spiritual and intellectual and magical experience and exploration. This is essentially what it is. The pressure of art brought to bear on time is the acorn version of it.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So there's a integrity or biointegrity between each of these different parts and components that you found, and there's all these different elements of science that are largely, or if not fully, compatible with the model you propose in MetaMagic.
Yeah. Another way to put it, if you're familiar with the work of Gene Gebser, he would be an important person to read in respect of this system. He had a big influence on it. He wrote a book called The Ever-Present Origin. And in it, he proposed there were five structures of human consciousness that emerged spontaneously at different times in human history. So the first is the archaic structure, which is basically the Tao. Basically, we are undifferentiated from the plenum, from the continuum. And then the magical structure, where we differentiated ourselves from this continuum, and we began to assert ourselves as monads in our individual world. So this would correspond to what you could see as early magical enchanted societies. And then this was followed by the spontaneous appearance of the mythic structure, which was characterized by epic social narratives that brought together these disparate monads and scaled them across time. So at this point, the calendars were invented. And then this is followed by the spontaneous appearance of the mental structure, which is the capacity to calculate and reduce and use reason, which of course we see in it dawns with Plato and during the Axial Age, peaks when Leonardo invents the vanishing point perspective, and then enters into a deficient phase, which is reductive materialism. And we are now at the cusp, according to Gebser, of a new structure, which is nascent, which is trying to express itself, which he calls the integral structure. And the integral structure represents the ability to take all the structures and allow them to operate on their own tiers as essentially like organs that take an input and give an output, and then the output feeds like an ecology into the others. And if you look around us, the reductive materialism is trying desperately to negate the previous structures, and the structures are at war with one another. But the integral structure is about realizing that they're operative on different planes. Magic is operative on a different plane than myth. It's operated on a different plane than science. And if you differentiate the planes, they become, instead of combatants in a single arena, they become organs in a single body, each with different functions. And I read this book, and my insight was to connect these to orbital centers. So I don't consider the archaic a structure. I don't use the word structure because it's loaded. The archaic, I allow it to be the plenum from which all emerges. So what happens? Human consciousness evolves when it identifies a center. The first center is the compass rose. So the compass rose is when we think about how much time it took human beings to realize that there's a north, a south, an east, and a west. This is not, you know, just like, ha-ha, you have to watch the stars, you have to watch the equinoxes and the solstices. It took forever for that to be realized. But when that was realized, there was the realization of a fourfold pattern in the universe. And so then you see gods like the Tetragrammaton, the Yahweh, Odin, Zeus, they're all demiurgic gods. The demiurgic gods emerged around the compass rose, and the compass rose is sent to the elemental locus of magic, which is why magicians operate in the circle. And then this, of course, reaches a peak, and it's efficient until it becomes a problem. It starts to produce side effects that are detrimental. For example, living in paranoid fear of other sorcerers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what happens to ameliorate that is the emergence of a new world order, a new, world economy or psychic economy. And this is based off of the geocentric system. So now the Ptolemaic system comes into play. We're looking at the universe in terms of astrology. We're looking at the universe in terms of the planets and their cycles. And so the mythic structure, so the magic structure is grounded in the compass rose. The mythic structure is grounded in the geocentric cosmology. And so it produces the whole, what we see as astrology and magic. And then it also becomes baroque and labyrinthine and top heavy. So what comes up to simplify it is this mental structure, you can call it. But what that ultimately is it's the shift to the heliocentric model. But the shift to the heliocentric model didn't suddenly happen in the middle of the Renaissance, right? That was a slow shift. In fact, Aristarchus and the earliest heliocentrists were contemporaries of Plato. So those ideas. So my sense is that heliocentrism was a submerged current all the way until the Copernican Revolution. So Copernicus, Kepler, Galileo, Giordano Bruno, who's anticipating the next one, Tycho Brahe is my favorite scientist, and then Newton. And so that is the world order that forms around the geocentric cosmology. So we're in this place now at the dawn of this nascent integral age, and we can see all sorts of evidence that the Newtonian model is shaking up, and we know that the sun isn't the center of the universe. And so we've discovered galaxies. Galaxies are a discovery that are, you know, is less than 200 years, I believe. And so what the integral structure is, I believe, is it's a dawning psychosocial economy that is centered in the galaxy. And when you ask a reductionist scientist whether the Earth orbits, whether religion or science, you know, which is right, they're going to say science is, and they're going to say religion believes that, you know, we're at the center of the universe and the sun goes around us. But that's not entirely true. But what happened in that era when that was what we phenomenologically experienced was we built an entire economy of story, of contemplation, of energy around that viewpoint. And that energy still cycles around that viewpoint. So science, or reductionist scientists, are trying to negate that viewpoint, but it's foolish because reductionist science is based on an equally negatable viewpoint, which is heliocentrism. We don't go around the sun. What we can do, and this is what the essence of metamagic is. Metamagic wants to be on the cusp of this galactic integration. And what it wants to do is recognize that the heliocentric model is nested inside of the galactic model, and the geocentric model is nested inside of the heliocentric model, and the magical model, or the compass rose, is nested inside of the geocentric. So what we have is a series of essentially like a Russian doll, where you've got the metamagic or the integral, then the scientific, then the mythic, and then the magical. And what we want to do is we want to practice all four of those tiers. We want to get them all working, and that's the effect we want to create. So that is basically what metamagic is.
And so, like, if you were to, like, label the Russian dolls in order cosmologically from the microcosm to macrocosm, how would you siphon those? How would you label those? All the way from the, like, even before the monad, but all the way up to the cosmic.
Well, I am hesitant to put them in an up-down axis because that has certain prioritizations. You know, so the you can start to import this idea of hierarchy, but how would I label them? Well, I mean, I would use Gebser, but I would just link it to these centers. So I would say the magical, the mythic, the mental, and the integral. Like, it's not broken, you know, I don't need to fix it. But I would say the magic is the compass. I would also say compass rose, geocentric, heliocentric, galactocentric. And of course, beyond the galaxy, there's going to be more, right? So this, and what's beautiful about this is, and this is true for Gebser, and this is why he called it the ever-present origin, is he saw that, he kind of saw it, these four structures as returning back into itself. So he didn't like Wilbur, just have a whole bunch of different, whole spectrum. Wilbur went with I haven't read much Wilbur. You gotta basically pick your battles while you're immortal, and so I'm sticking with Gebser. But my understanding is Wilbur's got 30 or something odd levels. But for Gebser, you've got Origin, which is this the Archaic, and then the others follow. But the Archaic is never gone, and we rediscover it in the Integral. So it sort of wraps around. And in that respect, because Gebser was he was a Christian, in that respect, the Tetragrammaton actually kind of makes another appearance, right? Where we could conceivably see these four centers as being the four letters of the name, right? So that's where, you know, microcosm and macrocosm, which direction do you want to go in? Do you want to put, I tend to go from magic, I tend to be sort of a ground up guy. So I go magic, mythic, mental, and then integral. But I mean, I suppose you could go from the other direction. But it's a question of whether you're going from order of emergence, or you're going from the alpha point towards the omega point, or the omega point towards the alpha point. And it actually doesn't matter, because if those are going in both directions at once, you get what David Chaim Smith calls palindromic resonance. And palindromic resonance frees us from being trapped in linear temporality.
Palindrome resonance. Linear temporality. And yeah, I was about to follow you up with the question of what kind of mental models are useful in the investigation of the world through a metamagic lens or through. So
I'm going to say cognitive science. It's very handy if you want to go at it from a sort of academic perspective. I highly recommend the work of George Lakoff, who wrote about he's a cognitive scientist, a second generation cognitive linguist, and he is distinguished by how he treats metaphor. Often metaphor was seen as an ornament of language that achieves aesthetic effects, but nothing more. However, Lakoff pointed out that metaphor is the basic way that we reason. And reason isn't a sort of algorithmic calculation, but rather a borrowing of the behavior of certain domains and the application of those behavior to other domains. So, for example, if I say, my relationship is spinning its wheels, I have basically said, okay, I'm not happy in my relationship, but I've used this metaphor that I borrowed from the car. And so now I can make other reasonings about, and this is literally from Lakoff, like Lakoff uses that example. I can make other inferences about my relationship. For example, have I gassed up? Or, have I checked the tire pressure? Which sounds kind of silly, but when you think about it, how do we reason? We reason around the structural metaphors that we have imported to model our cases. So this technique allows us to break down complex cultural concepts into the structural metaphors that give them their coherence. So container schema, something, if I have a container and I put something in that container and then I move that container, I am moving the something and the container. Well, try applying that to the tree of the Sephiroth. Try applying that to the I Ching. And you'll find that hold on a minute, all of these magical systems use metaphor extensively to create mental spaces that then at the same time are actual energetic expressions into the universe. So they're not just passive psychological reflections. They are acts of power. Change time. And so you can use cognitive linguistics. There's also a great scholar of esotericism named Egil Asperum, who wrote a very interesting little piece called Reverse Engineering Western Esotericism. It's a little academic essay, but it's basically about this is you can, and the argument is that we can use this to understand how these structures are built, but we don't have to just basically rip them apart like some, well, like a Marxist sort of attack on the superstructure, where we, you know, we said all cultural formations are somehow a bourgeois opulence, and we should just basically deconstruct them and leave them in pieces. And he's responding to an argument that was made that, no, we should deconstruct them and understand how the metaphors create the trees of life and the various different, the various different energy structures that the magician operates with. But this other argument was we should deconstruct it and then reconstruct it, you know, just leave it in place, right? You reconstruct it and now we understand it better. But Egil Asperum comes along and says, well, you can deconstruct it and then build something that hasn't been built before. So you can create new things without, in a way, damaging. I mean, you're in a way extrapolating the magical nature of any system and then using that extrapolation and that understanding to grow new ways of accomplishing that same task of comprehending the world, of energetically affecting the world. So what this puts us in the position of doing, speaking of this integral mutation, this integral structure, is to reform the elements of traditional magic on the horizon of the present, so that we are responding directly to the pressure of the now. So we're not just, reconstructing the Goetia. Going back and reconstructing an authentic PGM practice. You could do that. That would be a practice of the magical, the compass rose. That would be a practice of that level. But the truly integral approach would allow for that, would allow for deconstruction kind of thing, and would also allow for incorporating scientific findings and so forth without confusing them, without, blurring together the, a mythic account like the Trojan War with a literal account. And that's a big problem. It's confusion of the planes, right? People will want to make statements about the mythic in the same register that they make statements about facts. And those don't work in the same register. And if you try to collapse them, you end up with a flattened or a stalled system, right? An inelegant system. So, what I'm saying ultimately is that we can directly and nakedly surrender to the present and avail of all the tools that have ever been bequeathed to us by our ancestors, yet without the mandate to follow the rules that they laid down for themselves and for us, and instead with the, we'll say, with the it's hard to find the word for this. I don't want to say mandate again, but I have to. Instead with inspiration to essentially emanate a future without being determined by our legacy, and at the same time without abandoning our legacy. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, and much more. It's quite a can of worms, because it's ultimately we're talking about the scope of all human thought, existence, cognitive science, like linguistics, and figuring out like how to articulate these things. And so for me, I'm wondering about when it comes to the meta magic model and encompassing these systems.
Yeah.
There's like a taxonomy, maybe that's not the right term. And then there's a way to understand, label, containerize energy patterns. And then there's also a function of utility as well, like where now that we can make these distinctions, then how do we best employ this meta magic model to improve our lives, improve our cognitive understanding of sciences, and to have a new equinox, a new phase of understanding?
Well, I think that the horizon we're on involves essentially a kind of apocalypse of systems, where we see the systems that have brought us here, that have shaped our temporality. And the deepest of these systems that have the largest degree of, we'll say, comprehensive influence are the calendars. And so the calendars are stories that are mapped onto rhythms that then cause the story to eternally recur and support the worldview of the story as if they were measuring time. This is the great conceit of calendars, is that they measure time. This is what people think a calendar does, but it's not what a calendar does. A calendar sculpts time. A calendar takes a raw rhythm and then passes it through a filter of story, and then essentially creates a time stream, a timeline. I call this chronoforming. So a calendar chronoforms wild time. What is wild time? It's anything that oscillates. So wild time is that sum total of eternal oscillations from the atoms to the galaxy. So actually, how many timelines are there? It's an infinite and uncountable number. But human beings have discovered this ability to, because we have some very obvious rhythms in our, in our experience, we have discovered the ability to host narratives upon these rhythms. And so what that's done is it's caused the civilizations to emerge. And so what is a civilization? Generally speaking, a civilization is a people that have a calendar. And a calendar is what gives them the distinct nature. So, if you want to look at the different, who are the power players in our contemporary reality? Well, there's the different religions, right? So there's Christianity, and we have, of course, the Gregorian calendar, which has been reformed specifically at the time of the Industrial Revolution to accommodate the clock. So it has a certain quirk there. But of course, there's the lunar calendars, the Hebrew calendar, the Islamic calendar, the Chinese calendar, and it turns, of course, there's the Mayan calendar, which is incredibly sophisticated, as is the Balinese. And it turns out that there's all these calendars in the world that are like languages, and most of us are monoglots. And the problem with being a monoglot is that you can't think in parameters outside of your language. So if you learn another language, you learn a second language, suddenly you don't just have two languages. You have two languages plus the gap in between those languages. And you can see through the gap at the vast array of possibilities that are laid out by the fact that there are multiple different languages. The same is true of calendars. So if we start to realize that a calendar is an image of time that causes a particular ethos to eternally recur, we can re-understand our world as basically being corralled into these massive sort of juggernaut, juggernauts of socio-chronological momentum. And we can start to think, okay, well, what other possibilities are there? And we'll start to realize that there are other proposals. There are, there's a new age, there's a new age pseudo-Mayan calendar that is very popular in certain circles. It unfortunately purports itself to be the Mayan calendar when it isn't, but it's really probably the most vocal challenge, magical challenge to the Gregorian calendar. I think that it's sort of going about it the wrong way, because I think it wants to, you know, be the replacement for the Gregorian calendar, where I think that what we should just do is talk about how calendars are enchantments and not foreclose on what that means, and instead say, okay, if that's the case, and we raise awareness of that fact, what happens if a generation of people start saying, okay, so what can a calendar really do? If it doesn't measure time but sculpts it, can we become sculptors? Can we encourage a generation of magicians and thinkers to just essentially cut out the middleman and just invent and explore calendrics, and in that respect, utterly open the horizons of time, just completely open the horizons of time. Allow people to think about what a calendar based on a planet in another solar system is, because we've got all these exoplanets. And I think that will lead to the stage of development where we will be able to spread, maybe colonize other planets, and we'll really get out of these monolithic narratives that served us in previous structures, but are now deeply restrictive in terms of our need to enter into this integration, right? Like, as long as we don't see that we are in this fishbowl of time, then we're going to still think that, you know, we're going to still sort of unwittingly be carried by its rhythms, whereas I think we can free ourselves from that. I'll say one last thing. I'll tie this into Philip K. Dick, because Philip K. Dick famously wrote The Exegesis, which was kept in a garage for, like, probably in San Diego, if I'm not mistaken, but it was in a garage for like 30 years, and then it was finally rescued, and there was, some of it has been transcribed, and it's this wild bunch of stuff, and I've read it and I love it. And it's insane. But I think that Philip Dick in the Valis trilogy, without specifically saying it, he goes, you know, this is considered to be when he was going crazy, but doesn't read like crazy to me. It reads like absolutely visionary in a world that doesn't quite support that. And therefore it's a visionary accounting so far ahead of its time that it comes coupled with despair and with poverty and other sorts of things. But really, in essence, Philip Dick's vision of the Valis, which stands for Vast Active Living Information System, is basically this idea that he articulates, that he says the empire never ended, and that Rome encases time in a black iron prison. And the Holy Spirit, the Gnostic Holy Spirit, because he read, of course, the Gnostic Gospels, the Nag Hammadi text, comes backwards through time and tries to poke holes in this prison. And that's the Christian Holy Spirit is coming backwards through time. This kind of ties into Teilhard de Chardin, who has this omega point that's moving backwards to time. So for Dick, this apocalypse is uncovering the black iron prison, and I want to be absolutely explicit about it. The black iron prison is the Gregorian calendar. It is the perpetuation of the parameters of a Roman Empire as a deeply embedded socio-psychological, energetic, economic egregore or matrix that has a life of its own and has a hypnotic, this is the other term that I invented, is calendar hypnosis. Calendars hypnotize us into their patterns. And so this entity happens to be hypnotizing us to our detriment. Arguably, the late capitalist system is a direct product of the emanation of this rhythm. And if we kind of play a Buckminster Fuller game, and instead of trying to oppose it, try to design systems that are better than it, and flood reality with those better systems, then the next generation of systems will be even better, and the next will be even better. And we're opening up the possibility of an emergent blooming of a trans-calendrical epiphany. And without foreclosing it, without saying, no, it has to be the New Age Mayan calendar, it has to be this or that, but no. We don't know where it's going to end, but we can start it by asking the question. So that's what MetaMagic is really here to do.
That's fascinating, and I'm wondering, you've done the project of to help people create 10,000 different tarot decks, and I'm wondering if there's a project in mind to help create to chronoform 10,000 different calendar systems respectively.
That's I think naturally what will happen. The 10,000 tarots is this idea I had that I would like to be responsible directly or indirectly for the creation of 10,000 tarots, and I don't think I've achieved that goal yet. But the way that I do it is, one of the calendars that I have is based on the orbit of Venus, which has 224.7 Earth days. And I have broken it into, I've taken that 0.7 off, and I've broken it down to 224 days, which is 7 times 32. 32 is a famous Kabbalistic number, 32 paths of the wisdom, so the 10 Sephirot and the 22 paths. So 7 times 32 gives us a method whereby every week, starting on Friday, because Venus Day, every week you have a different tarot theme. So for a given year, week one is the ones, the aces, Kether. Week two is the twos, Chokmah, the deuces. Week three is the threes, so on, all the way down to the tens. And then week 11 is the world, the judgment, and then weeks 11 through 32 follow the paths, the major arcana, back up the tree. So a given year, well, every week will have a temporal theme, And the idea is that this is mapped onto the orbit of Venus. It creates so it has an objective, ontological momentum backing it up. But it then creates a wave where multiple people are all studying. So right now, for example, we're in temperance. So I've got a group of people, we're all studying temperance. Some people are making decks. Some people are making music. Some people are, what is a tarot? Is a tarot, could be a 22 stanza poem. That's a tarot, that's fair. So what all this creativity does, art, the pressure of art brought to bear on time, is it expresses this rhythm and it chronoforms Venus's orbit the input is Venus's orbit. The output is tarot decks. The 0.7 day is added every 10 years. There's an extra week. So it keeps the week evenly. It's accurate. It maintains time because it's got this leap year system, and the output is tarot decks. So this is an example of the reverse engineering of calendars, and then the re-engineering of a calendar whose output is tarots, as opposed to, like, the Gregorian calendar's output is money. That's what it does. It quantifies time and turns it into the concept of the wage. And that's what it outputs. But it does, they say time is money, but that's not true. Money is time, but time is not necessarily money. Time can also be art. Time can also be any number of things. So this is an example, the Venus calendar. I am completely confident that all I have to do is perpetuate the Venus calendar and have it succeed, have it basically get it a niche in the ecologies of time. It's called the Forest of Life, by the way. And I believe that as soon as the Forest of Life calendar finds its ecological niche in the culture or in the culture in general, then those 10,000 tarots are inevitable. So it's a kind of, in fact, I'm lowballing. 10,000 tarots is like fiddlesticks because it's exponential, right? If I'm conducting these, maybe I get 10 people to do it, but then maybe they're like, oh, I like this calendar, and they spread it to someone else, and boom, boom, boom. So, you know, as long as I'm indirectly connected to the production of the tarot, as long as the Forest of Life calendar has influenced the creation of the tarot, then it qualifies as one of the 10,000 tarots.
Yeah, and I like to add on one thing that makes me think about is that, you know, money is time in the Gregorian calendar, and now if people become from monogots to polygots, to going from one calendar to many calendars, what are things? Is it a metric of what metric do they quantify, or is that not the paradigm? Do they quantify? Is it a quality? Do they? And is the Gregorian calendar, since that's the primary consensus of reality, going to be culturally cannibalistic and turn these other potential calendars back towards money, acting as like Kronos eating, or
where we're playing with Aeon and they're sort of playing with Kronos. It's a good question. So I live in a place where every once in a while, every 10 years or so, maybe 20 years, these nasty little caterpillars come up and eat all the trees. And they're called spanworms. And they're really nasty little things. But the way, this is horrible, but the way that they deal with them is they have a biological agent that doesn't seem to, it's not a chemical, doesn't seem it doesn't seem to damage the environment. Anyway, they deal with it by introducing this biological agent that gets into the stomachs of the spanworms. They eat it, but then they can't eat anything else. It disrupts their digestion. So I kind of think that the Gregorian calendar has been able to eat most things, because most things have been on its terms. But I think that a sufficient proliferation of it basically exists in an environment where it can pretty much eat everything. But my sense is that these represent evolutionary developments that, if it attempts to eat them, it will be forced to dramatically change its own constitution. Now, I'm not one of these people who thinks it's a zero-sum game where we have to destroy the Gregorian calendar. In fact, I think that the moment you get yourself into a dialectic with the Gregorian calendar and you're reifying it, you're making it the enemy, and therefore it's getting strength from you. I don't give a fuck about the Gregorian calendar. Gregorianize away. I Gregorianize. I make money. I do these things. I just want to break the monopoly. And I think that, you know, it's a bit like punk rock. Punk rock got co-opted by the mainstream because it was such a, and that's not 100% true, but it to the degree that punk rock was a sort of display of rebellion, was the degree that it was able to be co-opted. But the degree that punk rock kind of slipped under the radar, so guys like Henry Rollins, who basically then was like, okay, I'll wear a tie, watch this, you know, hold my beer. Well, he doesn't drink, so hold my whatever Henry Rollins imbibes. I like Henry Rollins, by the way, he's a bit of a hero. But so So that's the strategy that I think works well is you just design outside the parameters of the toxic system, and then the toxic system is forced to try to catch up with you, and then evolve its form. And I have no doubt that the Catholic Church at some point will be like, holy shit, we can't deal with all these calendars, so we're going to have to reconstitute ourselves. And that would be great. I have no problem with that paradigm. I don't want to destroy it. I don't want to annihilate it. I just want to make it no longer the only option. And I think that's, yeah, I think it's a more realistic approach than trying to bring the system down. Just make the system optional.
Yeah, I'm wondering too, like, you know, different creatures work on their own chronology but through the lifespan, through their breath. You know, Vedic systems attribute to breath, some may attribute to heartbeat.
Cicadas. Now's the time to talk about the cicadas.
Cicadas. Oh, yeah.
You know what's happening with the cicada this summer, right?
No, I don't.
So there's two broods of cicadas, one which comes up every 17 years and then goes back down underground. They come up, breed, go back underground, come up, breed, go back underground every 17 years, called the circadian rhythm. And there's another that has a 13-year cycle. There's two broods. This is in the States. And the 13-year cycle, they come up, you know, so they're both prime numbers. And the idea is that they're happening on prime numbers to not be predictable by predators, right? You know, so predators aren't really prepared to handle them because they don't really know when they're coming. But so you got the 13 brood and you got the 17 brood. This summer, for the first time in like 200 years or 13 times 17 years, the two broods, this is combinatory of cicadas. So the States, you guys are going to be like, I almost want to come down and visit. You guys are going to be just like overrun by cicadas because the 13 and the 17 are both like coming up.
Wow. I don't know if I'm as thrilled as you are. They'll be at our expense, but for you.
They're awesome. Anyway, whatever. Yeah, you're horrified. Oh my God, it's the Call of Cthulhu. Have a nice day.
Oh, wow. So like,
I interjected there, but I was just got excited.
Oh, well, yeah, that was great. Yeah, I did want to hear a bit more about alternative ways or parallel societies, parallel ways of acting in the world, and by creating, like, assigning the tarot to the Venusian calendar system that you created, it creates its own psychic agrory, maybe agrory is not the right word, but it creates an perpetuity system.
Yeah.
Ontological
momentum.
We do that for other parallel societies or systems to enact the patterns that are programmed into it. And is that like an astrological function or are there other functions or chronologies that can be based off of other things?
Well, it's interesting to note that our time has three external reference points. So our current time, mass time, has three external reference points: the sun, the moon. So our calendar, the Gregorian calendar, is a solar calendar, but the Easter calculations are lunar. So there's a vestigial lunar calendar inside of it. So it's got the sun and the moon. It's called the computus, by the way. That's what the Catholics, and they use all sorts of sophisticated medieval tables and stuff to calculate the date of Easter. But it's called the computus, and it is the vestigial lunar calendar within the Catholic calendar. But the other referent is the cesium atom. So we have atomic time, and atomic time was instituted in the 60s, I believe, and it measures a nanosecond as a given number of oscillations of the cesium atom, as opposed to a millisecond, which is a metric subdivision. A millisecond is just, you know, a second divided by 1,000. And so that's an abstract thing, but a nanosecond is not an abstract thing. A nanosecond is an empirical concrete thing. So every time a calendar links to an oscillating body, it is chronoforming it. So this is what happened when we came up with atomic time. We chronoformed the cesium atom. That's really what we did. So we brought that into our rhythm. And of course, we can see what's happened, right? It's radically sped things up. It's allowed for the deployment of satellites. Like you can't use metric to coordinate satellites. You need this nanosecond, right? So that's why they did it. So it just shows you that every time you bring a oscillating rhythm from the cosmos, raw time, and you chronoform it, you're bringing a new variable into play. So largely the calendars of the world are lunar or solar. There are some that have, like the Mayan, that have geocentric relationships to the planets like Venus, Mars, and so forth. For example, the Tzolk'in, which is the 260-day calendar of the Maya, is supposed to be a Venus calendar, but it's probably actually a Mars calendar, because 260 times 3, whatever that number is, I don't know it on the top of my head, that is the same as the synodic period of Mars, which means Mars and the Earth from conjunction to conjunction is 260 times 3 days. Probably the old Mayan calendar was a Mars calendar. And yet they had multiple calendars that had their highest common denominators would match as many of the synodic periods as possible. So what they wanted to do is use numbers that could use numbers, as many numbers in their calendars as possible, such that every synodic period of the major planets could fit in some way. So there's an 819-day cycle that is, the Maya were wild. So they were chronoforming other planets, but not from a heliocentric point of view, from a geocentric point of view. The Balinese calendar is a 210-day ritual cycle. It's really cool. I don't know whether it's mapped onto anything. The week is its own calendar. The seven-day week is not actually related to the Gregorian calendar. It was a Jewish innovation that was brought back from Babylon, entered into the Roman calendar like a mitochondrion going into the cell, and then formed a symbiosis with it, and then essentially transformed the society around the time that Christianity rose.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's amazing.
Yeah, so the calendars are not singular things. Actually, most calendars are made of sub-calendars. And sometimes those sub-calendar like components will like migrate. It's like a crazy biological system.
Yeah, and I suppose does this have any connection to holidays? Like in the United States, how like we've created a bunch of made-up holidays for consumption, to help for consumerism, like Pirate's Day, show up with the pirate hat, get a free ice cream or Slurpee. Where do you see there being more sinister applications and culturally cannibalistic, and that,
The most sinister account I've ever read of calendars gone horribly fucking wrong is in Infinite Jest by
David Foster Wallace.
Yeah. So he's got this system where at a certain point they stop counting. He's got this dystopia where they stop counting years in numbers, and every year has a corporate sponsor. So it's like, what does it start? I'm looking for it now. It's on my it's on my wall. And so how does it start? It starts for me, the year of glad, right? And so the first chapter is the year of glad. And then what's the next year? Year of the depend adult undergarment. Like, So that there's a cannibalistic, so imagine that. Imagine, yeah, the corporate takeover, the names of the year. So that's an example of cathexing a kind of or imprinting an association on, because this is basically, we'll go back to the cognitive science of it. It's forging an association between a day and an idea. So may the 4th be with you. You know, so Star Wars Day is May 4th, and that is kind of a cultural phenomena. It's a meme. It's a mimetic phenomenon, not in the restrictive sense of memes, as you know, just like images, but like in the richer sense that Dawkins meant it as a viral idea. So it's mimetic in its nature, and it's ways. I would say that they start off innocent. I don't think it's like cynically designed to be corporate, but it's happening within capitalism. So it's subject to, anything that people are enthusiastic about in capitalism will be sold back to them. Punk, may the 4th be with you, all that stuff. It just gets, because that's how capitalism works, converts time into money. I think that if you really want to free yourself, you should link your holy days to like other calendars altogether. That's how you become incommensurable to it. If it's hosted on the Gregorian calendar, it's going to become an organ of that calendar.
Wow, that makes a ton of sense, because I don't believe Islam's on the Gregorian calendar. It's lunar.
Yeah.
And, Thais have their own calendar, and a lot of other systems that are very much, when I visit them or been amongst the cultures, it's very much a parallel society that feels that it can function with the Gregorian calendar, but it functions by itself on its own entirely.
Successful diasporas almost always have their own calendar. So the Jews are Judaism is the largely diasporic. Of course, we have Israel, but there's this enormous diaspora for centuries, and yet they were able to maintain their autonomy, and they have their own timeline, and they have their own calendar. In fact, one of the reasons that they were probably, able to, my guess is that the getting away from Egypt. So here's an interpretation of the book of Exodus. I would say that a combination between having a calendrix and having an alphabet whereby they could educate or make literate every person in their community enabled them to basically be like oil and water. So they're inside of Egypt, but they're not assimilated to Egypt. And then the parting of the Red Sea, you can read it as a literal miracle, or you can read it as they were able to access a territory that the Egyptians were not. In other words, they had the phonetic alphabet, and then they had their own calendar, and so they were basically able to get out of reach of the influence of the magic of the Pharaoh, or the influence of the Pharaoh altogether, and they were able to essentially retain their autonomy that way. So I would read the Exodus as related to similar factors, right? These types of whole society scale enchantments. Islam is obviously another example, and the Chinese calendar is an excellent example. The Chinese are an amazing example of a diaspora community that's been in North America for centuries, and yet strangely, it's almost like if you're not tuned into it, you don't see it. You just kind of this like it turns invisible. I love this about the Chinese culture. I'm a pretty sinophilic, and when you notice it, when you know a little Chinese, and when you're in tune with it, you see it. But it's almost like it's just You ever read The Illuminatus?
No.
Okay, so this is Robert Anton Wilson, but they come up with this word, they call it phenord. And a phenord is this word that, like, everyone's conditioned to not notice. And but an indication that a publication is being actually part of the conspiracy is it's filled with phenords. You read them and you don't notice them, and you just kind of like get vaguely uneasy and put the publication down, unless you're an Illuminatus, in which case, oh, phenords, and then you go in. So I thought that was interesting. So sometimes I think, you know, there's elements of Chinese culture that sort of function like that in the diasporas, that you know, they have an autonomy that I really admire, based on their calendrics and their ideographic mentality and ideographic language, and I just find that diaspora community is really interesting to me.
Ooh. Have you found that in any other type of diasporic communities, like say like the Irish or like people from India or I don't know. I'm thinking extensively about that. Not even migrants or people who are like refugees, like the crisis, like refugees, like that from like global warming or.
Right. And I mean, this basically comes down to, you know, if your culture is strong, you're able to sustain your existence wherever you are without assimilation. And if your culture is, for whatever reason, compromised, and sometimes this is because of a great act of violence, then you are assimilable into the larger culture. So one of the things I'm thinking about is the Cornish, right? So, you know, in England, you got Cornwall, which had its own language, but Cornwall is, you know, very few people speak Cornish. Actually, more people are learning with this. When I was there, there was 300 Cornish speakers, which is awesome. But the Welsh, of course, have got their language back, right? And so the Welsh, I mean, they're not a diaspora community. They're the original Britons, right? But they're heavily colonized. So it just doesn't just mean diaspora communities. It can be also hyper-colonized people. So the Welsh are like really, really, really colonized, and yet they've got the language and they've got a world that they can create. The Irish, the question, I guess, comes down to what degree it comes down to Catholicism, right? It comes down to, and here's where I really don't want to make any blanket statements. But, you know, there's a tension, obviously, between the Protestants and the Catholics, but even more so, there's Druidry. So the question then is, what really happened to the Druids? Did the Druids get defeated by the Romans? Or did the Druids pull a kind of a vanishing act? Because I have a feeling that with the Druids and with Ulms, right, the Druidic alphabet, which is, among other things, associated with trees, they had a real aesthetic of oh, you've defeated us. Oh, we're done. Okay. And then they just sort of disappear behind that superficial defeat, but perhaps a more fundamental victory, because it's interesting that, you talk about reverse engineering paradigms. The Church of England is a total reverse engineer of the Catholic system. So, unlike, you know, these fragmentary Protestantisms that exist late Protestantism, American fundamentalism, or just fundamentalism in general, the Church of England feels like just a complete, like, bit by bit, how do I describe it? It's like an IBM clone. Like they figured out the source code and just reproduced it with a few subtle tweaks, and then created autonomy. So that feels to me the sort of things the Druids might do. And I know that certain Masonic orders connect themselves to the Druids, and so the Druids have a society of secrecy, of being able to disappear, sometimes I wonder when you talk about Ireland, to what degree is it colonized by the Catholic paradigm, and to what degree is it also running, you know, a deep druidic program? And of course, there's druidic calendars, and you know, Robert Graves composed the Ogham calendar, which is not, I mean, he was poetic, but you know, maybe there are legitimate druidic, you know, calendars going back all the way, you know, to Iceland's another example. Iceland was superficially colonized by Christianity, Danish Christianity, but in the homes they were practicing Asatru, and they still do. And you know, I have some friends who created an Asatru temple. They have a legit temple in Reykjavik, and they've got their own calendrical systems. I mean, the Icelanders are amazing because they've got the best preserved cultural literary record of anywhere in the world. They've got complete genealogical records of every person in Iceland going back to settlement in the 10th century. They've got loads and loads and loads and loads of literature that we don't even know about, including calendars, including magic, including deep stuff, because basically their strategy was we're going to populate this. I mean, they were also universally literate by the 10th century, like Judaism. Viking was an activity, right? So Viking was something that they did. But the Icelanders, they had democracy by the 10th century, so they were electing their kings. They were living in an environment that was so harsh that they weren't really subject to invasion. But perhaps the only culture that I know of that is even more adapted is the Inuit to, you know, harsh environments. but yeah, the Vikings, and they were universally literate by the 10th century. They were writing, you know, the sagas and all sorts of stuff. And so they've got loads of stuff, and it's preserved in archives. It's wild.
Wow. That's phenomenal. And I'm wondering, since we're getting close to the end of the hour, we're already well past it, but
the end of the second hour. Yeah. Yeah.
I really, really enjoy this conversation, and I'd love to know, is there any like last pieces of advice you'd give to folks who are looking to implement or chromaform their life or get into meta magic, the 10,000 Tarot project?
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, I'll just plug my stuff now, if that's right. if you followed this discussion and you sat through this whole discussion, then I'm sure you have some ideas about it, right? So you start with those ideas, right? Start with your own response to what I've said, which is all about autonomy. That's really what I'm speaking about, is the engineering of autonomy, how cultures engineer autonomy and how we can engineer autonomy through our psychoeconomic energy patterns. And we can create an ecology of autonomies that are interconnected and that feed each other, that raise each other up. So start where you are, obviously, in encountering this podcast. But if you want to explore more of the work that I've done and have an encounter with that, I have an Instagram account right now that's quite active. It's called the 10,000 Tarots. I have a Facebook page, which is Meta Magic Matrix, magic with a C, I believe. Sometimes I put a K in, but the Facebook is with a C. Of course, there's Perseus, right? So Perseus Arcane Academy has been, you know, those guys are fantastic. They've got some of the best esotericists and the most interesting minds, then they provide a platform for some amazing stuff and some courses. So I have a course, which is an intro to Meta Magic, which is basically a series of activities. It's meant to, there's seven modules, and there's some things you can make. It's basically you create a set of alter tools that are part of creating our field system, because metamagic is also about producing fields of autonomy around ourselves, basically, and using magic squares. I didn't talk that much about magic squares, but using magic squares to create palindromic resonance fields. That's essentially what it is. So that's what that course is. But I'm building right now a much bigger course. It's a 32 unit course that has videos and PDFs and guided meditations. It follows the entire tarot. It's called the Metamagic Tarot. It's going to be on Perseus in three parts. And what's more is I actually have a course every 32 weeks. I do it live. So you can join my course. You can either go through Perseus and just buy this material and do it on your own time, or you can come to me, or you can go to Perseus and come to me. And only if you buy from Perseus, if you buy the course from Perseus, you can come and participate in my live course once for a nominal fee. So basically you wouldn't have to pay. So my course is $250 a part. So that's 10 weeks. The pricing of the Perseus is going to be $200. If you want to take the Perseus course, buy it, check it out, and then you decide, I'm going to take the live course. The first time you do that, you just give me $50. Make up the difference is essentially the thing. So that's exciting. So if you want to hang out with me and have these conversations, then that's the way to do it. And also there'll be some books coming out. There's almost too much to talk about, but I would say start by checking out my website and consider my courses on Perseus Arcane Academy.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being on the show. It was fantastic talking with you and exploring ways for myself and for others to gain more magical autonomy and also literal autonomy, and to create parallel communities, societies, ways of being in the world.
Awesome. Well, this is what we're here for, right? This is the great work.
That's the great work.
All right.